The New Insights Project is very pleased to have Alan Hayek here from the Australian National University. Alan's published on a wide range of topics, including especially decision theory, probability, issues in philosophy of religion, and today he's going to speak to us on deliberation welcomes prediction. We'll do about an hour's worth of talk, and then about 40 to 45 minutes of Q&A, after which we'll adjourn to some drinks, if you would like to join us.
Thanks. Thanks, Matt, and thanks for setting this up. And I know it's been complicated, but you've been terrific. Thanks also to Rachel. Thanks for coming. Tonight, you will face the pleasant choice of having either red wine or white wine with your dinner. Now, maybe you have subjective probabilities for what you'll choose now. Maybe not. But a number of authors claim that once you begin deliberating about this choice, you cannot have such probabilities on pain of irrationality. I disagree, and I'll tell you why I disagree for most of this talk, but at the end I'll talk a bit about Pascal's wager and the ramifications of this debate for the wager. I'll approach the debate in stages. So first, satellite view, and then I'm going to zoom in, and then I'm going to zoom in again. So satellite view. Start with some propositional attitude. Are there propositions to which this attitude cannot be held, or at least cannot rationally be held? Are there gaps for the attitude of necessity or on pain of irrationality? And I'll especially be interested in the irrationality question, but of course, if you just can't hold the attitude to certain propositions, then you can't rationally hold it. And it's especially interesting if there are true propositions to which the attitude cannot rationally be held. For example, let the attitude be knowledge. Are there propositions, even true ones, that cannot be known? According to Fitch's paradox, there are. According to it, necessarily, if in fact there's an unknown truth, and there surely is, then there's a truth that cannot be known. Or let the attitude be belief. Are there propositions that cannot rationally be believed? According to Moore's paradox, there are propositions of the form P and I don't believe that P, P and I believe that not P, it's raining and I don't believe it's raining. I keep on wanting to make rain jokes on this sort of tour of England, and it's, anyway. Well, Fitch's paradox and Moore's paradox give us respectively knowledge blind spots and belief blind spots in Sorensen's term, and he argues that there are more. For example, the surprise exam paradox generates them. The boundaries of vague predicates. Subjective probabilities, credences, are important, perhaps even fundamental, propositional attitudes. Are there rational credence blind spots? Propositions to which one cannot rationally assign credences. And as we'll soon see, several authors think that there's an interesting and easily characterized class of such propositions. Okay, let's zoom in a bit more. This is the aerial view. I've long been interested in probability gaps, especially for subjective probability functions. And if there are any such gaps, they're problematic for a number of pillars in Bayesian epistemology. So starting with conditional probability, I've campaigned for many years against the usual ratio formula for conditional probability. P of A given B is the ratio P of A and B over P of B. And one of my main arguments is from probability gaps. So let G be such a gap for P. So P of G is undefined, but various conditional probabilities involving G, it seems, should be defined. P of G given G equals 1. P of G given not G is 0. And so on. And it seems like the ratio formula founders on these cases, P of G given G, the ratio, understood that way, seems to be a ratio undefined divided by undefined, and that's not 1 or 0, as it might be, because the gap P of G is undefined. Conditionalization. So the problem for the ratio formula quickly becomes a problem for this favored rule for updating, which just understands conditional probabilities in the usual vanilla way. So you know conditionalizing. Suppose you initially have a probability function, you get some piece of evidence that's your strongest piece of evidence, and you update. So you make what used to be your conditional probabilities your new probabilities. But what about if E, your evidence, is a gap, then you can't conditionalize on something that you initially assigned no probability to, not by the ratio formula. So it seems we can't model your learning a gap, by conditionalization. Decision theory. So decision theory's central notion is expected utility, and the theory's mantra is that rational action maximizes expected utility. But now let G be a probability gap for you, and consider these options. Option one, you get $1 million if G is true, nothing otherwise. Option two, you get nothing. I say you should choose option one, but its expected utility is undefined since the probability of G is undefined. So choosing option one does not maximize expected utility. So that's a problem for expected utility theory. Independence. Independence is a key concept in probability theory. When two propositions are independent, the truth of one of them is completely uninformative about the truth of the other, probabilistically speaking. And textbooks ritually tell us that A and B are independent just in case you have this nice factorization of the joint probability. So what are we to say about probability gaps for which the corresponding equation fails to hold? So you've got P of G is undefined. So then P of G and X and P of G times P of X, the worry is what happens when you've just got question mark and question mark undefined on both sides of this equation. Well, if we say the propositions that are not independent are dependent, then we have the absurdity that G is dependent on every proposition. If we say that there's no verdict either way, when you've got the question marks, the undefined terms, well, then we get embarrassing silences where we want answers. So, for example, I would have thought that any proposition, at least whose probability is less than one, is dependent on itself. You couldn't get more informative than the proposition itself. But if we have a gap, our formula won't say that. Regularity. Common sense says, many philosophers agree, that some version of so-called regularity should hold. This is a staggeringly unmnemonic term for a very intuitive thought. Let's call it open-mindedness. If P is possible, if X is possible, then the probability of X is positive. And I think that's part of folk thinking about probability. In fact, I did a study of this. I did an empirical survey. I asked two of my friends, and they agreed. And I think this is deeply entrenched. But never mind the folk. Versions of regularity as a rationality constraint have been proposed by Kemeny, Shimoni, Jeffrey, Edwards, Lindemann, Savage, Carnap, Stolnacker, Lewis, Skirms, Appiah, I keep going. And then more recently too, people like Hofweber, Van Mackers. So it's got a pull. Now, different senses of possible give us different senses of regularity, but whichever sense we might favour, probability gaps look problematic. So let G be possible in the requisite sense, but a gap, then we've got it's possible, but its probability is not positive. Its probability is not anything, because it doesn't have one. And so it goes. So credence gaps wreak havoc for various foundational notions, first in probability theory, but then that quickly gets imported to formal epistemology. So it's especially important if there's an interesting class of credence gaps for a rational agent. Now, we might be able to find sort of clever technical examples, maybe non-measurable sets or maybe self-referential propositions or something. But no, if we can get some really easily identified mundane class, that is big news. And a number of prominent authors think exactly that. And now, zoom in again, it's time to get in the trenches with them. And we're up to section three. So the deliberation crowds out prediction thesis, as it's being called, And here's the view. While deliberating about what you'll do, you cannot rationally have credences for what you'll do. So you're deliberating about whether to have red or white wine. And according to the view, you cannot rationally assign half-half or three-quarters a quarter or anything to your choices. And so it is with all decisions. Now, to be sure, other agents may be able rationally to assign credences to what you eventually choose. Onlookers don't have this problem. The problem is supposedly one of assigning credences reflexively, a first-person problem. So one cannot have credences for one's own options while deliberating. Let's call those option credences on pain of irrationality. Option credences are irrational. Well, this has come to be known as the deliberation crowds out prediction thesis, following Levi. I don't think prediction is quite the right word. You know, we often assign credences to things without making predictions in the ordinary sense. You know, I assign probability 1 in 1,000,000 to each of the million tickets winning next week's lottery. And there's a good sense in which I'm not making a prediction. In a way, that's the whole point. I'm not predicting, but I am assigning credences. I'll give the thesis another name, and it might give you a little hint also on which side I will jump in this debate. I'll call it the dark thesis. Deliberation annihilates reflexive credences. But actually, some of the arguments, and we'll get to them soon, almost have a certain occult quality to them. Anyway, versions of the dark thesis have been advocated by authors such as, I said, Levi Sponne, Seidenfeld, Gilboa, Price, and others. And even others have flirted with the dark side. Geifman, Collins, Rachel Briggs are sympathetic to it. Sponne and Gilboa couch their versions of the thesis in terms of modelling credences. We shouldn't model rational agents as assigning option credences. That might sound like they're not fully subscribing to the dark thesis, but actually they are. And Sponne, for example, says probably anyone will find it absurd to assume that someone has subjective probabilities for things which are under his control, in which he can actualize as he pleases. I don't. We're up to section 4. So here I want to register some initial concerns about the dark thesis. So these are not meant to be fatal. Well, actually, maybe it depends. But they prompt some unease about it, at least initially. First, when we're deliberating about what we'll do, we are uncertain about what we'll do. Probability is our best theory of uncertainty, so offhand, we should assign probabilities to what we'll do, or at least we may. So this is just meant to be a sort of warm-up point that the thesis is by no means the natural default position, if anything, quite the opposite. But now let's get a bit more serious. Secondly, the dark thesis imposes a new constraint on credences beyond the usual Bayesian ones, that they obey the probability calculus and that they update by conditionalizing. Now, this is big news for Bayesianism, and if true, should be written in neon lights. And actually, more than that, it contradicts orthodox Bayesianism. So consider a case in which initially you idly contemplate a decision that you'll make sometime in the future. It might be next week's red wine versus white wine choice. Time passes, and eventually the time to make the decision arrives. And you begin deliberating about it. And then finally, you make your decision. Now, it's perfectly compatible with the dark thesis that at the initial and final times, you have credences for what you'll do. In fact, various proponents of the thesis explicitly say there's nothing problematic about these, you know, well ahead of time and then also looking back after the deliberation's over. It's only during the intermediate period while you're deliberating that the credences are forbidden. Okay, so suppose you have credences for your options outside that forbidden period. So we have two revisions of your probability function. So your credences for your options suddenly vanish when your deliberation commences, and they suddenly appear when it ends. So that's two revisions. Neither revision takes place by conditionalization. And this contradicts the Bayesian cornerstone that conditionalization is the only way in which credences may be revised. Thirdly, relatedly, the dark thesis conflicts with the reflection principle. According to reflection, your credence in X at time T should be your expectation of your credences in X at a later time, T prime. Okay, suppose now you have not yet begun deliberating about the wine to accompany your dinner. You assign a credence to your choosing the red wine when the time comes. Let's say it's a half. So far, no conflict with the dark thesis. Suppose also that you believe that you will be deliberating about the choice of wine at 7 p.m. That's probably about right. According to the dark thesis, your credence for red wine should be undefined then. So your expectation of your 7 p.m. credences for red wine should be undefined now. But they're not. I imagined you're assigning half. And that seemed, the half seemed unproblematic. So we have a violation of reflection. Fourthly, you can make comparative probability judgments about your options, I would say, and it's unclear why numerical probabilities should pose any special problem. You judge that you're more likely to have red wine with your dinner than to have red wine followed by port with your dessert. And that in turn is more likely than you're having a shot of petrol. It's one of these quirky Oxford restaurants. Okay. And I don't see why numerical probabilities create a special problem. And comparative probabilities over your options may be especially apt when the deliberation takes place over a long period of time and things change along the way. Suppose you're choosing between two job offers at two universities. The decision is complicated. You have to weigh many factors. It's drawn out. And then the dean at one of the universities suddenly sweetens the deal. She increases your salary for that job by $10,000. Now, it's natural for your probability of taking that job to go up, even though I'm imagining your deliberation is not yet over. And this cannot be squared with the dark thesis. And more generally, when you deliberate about your options, you weigh in turn the pros and the cons. And as a pro comes in, it's natural for your probability of choosing it to increase. You know, con, decrease. Fifthly, it seems you can have evidence regarding how you'll choose. You can have evidence, for example, your past choices in similar situations, or the choices of people similar to you in similar situations. And indeed, it seems you could have more evidence than other people do regarding your choice. You get to look at your own volition too. So it seems odd that they may assign credences to what you'll choose, but you may not, when it seems your evidential basis is superior to theirs. Sixthly, consider a Perry Lewis-style de se ignorance case. You have a lot of evidence regarding an agent's decision situation, but you're uncertain who the agent is. So you know a lot about their options, their utility function, their behavioral dispositions, and so on. And on that basis, you form credences on what they'll choose. And then you suddenly discover their identity. The agent is you. It seems odd that your credences should suddenly vanish. Seventhly, there will be downstream consequences of the dark thesis for other propositions. I may believe or assign high credence to biconditionals between what I choose and other propositions. Suppose I'm deliberating between going to Italy and going to Iraq for a holiday. And I believe that my wife, Renee, will be worried if and only if I go to Iraq. By the dark thesis, I cannot have a credence for my wife will be worried. If I did, it would fix my credence for I go to Iraq at the same value. Or suppose that I believe a biconditional between something I'm deliberating about now and something I'm not. I'm choosing between having pizza and Chinese, and today is Thursday, and it's 2-for-1 pizza nights on Thursdays. I believe that however I choose tonight, I'll choose the same way next Thursday. In fact, I believe this perhaps in virtue of my rationality. My reasons for one choice or the other will be the same now as then, and then as now. By the dark thesis, I'd better not have a credence for next week's choice. Or suppose I have a twin faced with the same decision problem as I have, and I believe that however he chooses, so will I. So by the dark thesis, I'd better not have a credence for how he chooses. And all of these, seventhly, points carry over, even if there's merely a correlation between the relevant propositions by my lights. Similarly, probabilities propagate through entailments. So the dark thesis prohibits various credence assignments to the consequences of one's options. I'll go to Italy for a holiday entails I'll go somewhere for a holiday. If I assign credence less than one to the latter, that puts an upper bound on my credence for the former. So imagine I assign probability 0.9 to my going somewhere for a holiday, then my probability for going to Italy for a holiday is bounded above by that value, and at worst my credence would be spread over the interval 0 to 0.9. So by the dark thesis, I must not assign credence less than one to I'll go somewhere for a holiday while deliberating about whether I'll go to Italy. Well, look, to be sure, proponents of the dark thesis can embrace all of these downstream consequences. Indeed, they may say, I should not assign credence to my wife's worrying or to next Thursday's choice or to my twin's choice, or credence less than one to going somewhere for a holiday. Still, let's just be clear, the dark thesis ramifies to propositions about which I'm not currently deliberating. So probability gaps are even more widespread. Anyway, be all of that as it may, the dark thesis has much currency, and if true, it would provide a rich source of probability gaps, and I've indicated my long-standing interest in those. And again, they would not be esoteric cases. They're not non-measurable sets or anything. They're as simple as I will order red wine. I'll go to Italy for a holiday. But if there are such gaps, they're problematic for various foundations of probability theory and thus formal epistemology. The stakes are high. I'm going to have a very brief intermission. Some of you will know this story about Jim Joyce when he was on the job market. Jim Joyce, you know, decision theorist, and his writing sample was on causal decision theory. And he went into the job and he gave his spiel on causal decision theory. And then one of the interviewers said, So what's the Kant angle? And it turned out that they'd actually shuffled the files and this was the wrong candidate. They thought this was the Kant scholar they were interviewing. Soon you'll see why I mentioned that. We're up to 5 arguments for the dark thesis. So I'm going to group these main arguments. I've been scouring the literature into their main themes. The first ones, arguments 1 through 4, will concern agency. The 5th, vacuity. 6 and 7, betting. And then finally, theoretical considerations. And then after that, we'll be in a position to talk about Pascal's wager. So 5.1, not at all loaded. I'm going to call it the murky free will argument. So, look, first I want to begin with more of a gesture to an argument for the dark thesis than a real argument. I've discussed the dark thesis with many philosophers, a number of whom are sympathetic to it, and when I press them for arguments, I often get a response that I will parody as follows. And to be fair, soon we're going to look at more precise versions. But for now, let me give you the parody. Blah, 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 agency. Blah, 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 free will. Blah, 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 Kant. That's the Kant angle. Therefore, the dark thesis. That's what Jim Joyce should have said. Anyway, so even the published literature in favour of the thesis has moments like this. And there is something seductive, and I feel it. I feel the pull, that there's something about the very nature of free agency that somehow precludes these option credences. But still, I want to hold proponents of the thesis. I want to hold their feet to the fire. So I really want to hear the details of the argument. But even before we get to such details, and we just have this sort of wishy-washy argument, we should be on alert. So even this argument sketch risks proving too much. So the vague things said about agency and the hands waved at free will seem to apply just as readily in the third person case as in the first person case. So I'm now trying to give credences to what you'll do. Blah, 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 you're free. Blah, 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 you're an agent. What? Therefore, I shouldn't be assigning credences either. That doesn't seem right. So we really want to hear the details of why it matters in the first person case. Okay. And by the way, I can also wave my hands to the opposite conclusion. Blah, 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 free will may all the more ground one's option credences. Anyway, now let's get a bit more precise. So this is 5.2, and this is Hugh Price's argument. We just had a big conference nearly a week long in Cambridge that was very much on this topic and related things. So Price wants to distance himself from Pearl's view that there's evidence regarding how actors will choose, but that actors should ignore it. And he continues, whereas the point should be that there isn't evidence in the first place from the actor's own perspective. And he's inspired by Ramsey, who said, any possible present volition of ours is for us irrelevant to any past event. To another, or to ourselves in the future, it can serve as a sign of the past. But to us now, what we do affects only the probability of the future. In a sense, my present action is an ultimate and the only ultimate contingency. Okay, so let me spell out what I take to be Price's argument here in a bit more detail. So the key premise, one, while deliberating, you have no evidence for how you will choose. Now, Price gets straight to the dark thesis conclusion, but I think we need some bridge between evidence and credence, and so I've put in, your credences should reflect your evidence. Conclusion, dark thesis. Okay, I reply against one. Well, and I've said this before, and this will come up again and again, from the actor's own perspective, there's better evidence, I would say, not worse evidence, still less no evidence for what they'll do. Not worse evidence than there is from a third-person perspective. So introspective evidence about one's own volition provides more basis, I would say, for the assignment of credences that one might use beyond the publicly available stuff, like what I did in the past or what people like me did. And in fact, following Joyce, we may go so far as to say that your volition trumps such information. It generates its own evidence. You get to make the news, and you get to know it ahead of everyone else. And more on that shortly, because interestingly, Price will take that same premise and then jump exactly the opposite way. In fact, we might even be able to say a bit more about the nature of this extra evidence that you have at your disposal. Ells calls it a tickle, that you may introspect, and he mounts his famous tickle defense of evidential decision theory in the face of Newcomb's problem on the basis of such evidence, you know, that inclination that you can feel. Against two, yes, your credences should reflect your evidence, but they should also reflect your priors. You've reminded me of this. And there's no difficulty with your assigning prior probabilities to what you'll end up choosing long before you face the moment of choice. And then maybe option credences are exceptions to premise two. Maybe they give rise to a non-evidential way to have rational credences. And then what about the inference? So let's just grant the premises. Does it follow that you should have no credence for how you'll choose? Well, maybe, but proponents of the principle of indifference will insist that no. On the contrary, your lack of evidence forces certain credences on you. Now, to be sure, the principle of indifference has hit hard times. And people think that Bertrand's paradoxes decisively refuted it. Although, interestingly, often these same people tacitly appeal to the principle of indifference in various cases, as it might be Sleeping Beauty or the Monty Hall problem. Now, who would be so bold in the Sleeping Beauty problem not to be a halfer or a thirder, but a 17th-er, you know, completely, you know, distancing oneself from principle of indifference-like considerations? Or in the Monty Hall problem, the probability that I give to the prize being behind door one is one on route two. And in certain cases of free choices, maybe the principle of indifference does have a certain pull. Think of Buridan's ass. Think of yourself in a maze. You're deliberating, should I go left or right? Maybe at least at the outset, 50-50. But anyway, regarding the quote from Ramsey, I don't see there any argument for the dark thesis. It's an argument that evidence from the past that may be available to others is unavailable to me. But that falls short of showing that I have no evidence. And again, maybe in fact I have better evidence, you know, the tickle. And also Ramsey was no friend of evidential probability, and I think he would have been happy assigning subjective probabilities even in the absence of evidence, and we call them priors. We're up to 5.3. So this is Price again, and he writes, one route to, as I would say, the dark thesis, turns on the special epistemic authority of the deliberating agent concerning her own actions. This authority trumps any merely predictive knowledge claim about the same matters, rendering it necessarily unjustified. And in Cambridge, he spoke of two different ways of knowing that P. One is by reflection and one is by decision. And he gave them even names. The first was Arthur and the second was Martha. And then he said, Martha trumps Arthur. Okay, so I reply, grant that the deliberating agent has special epistemic authority. Grant that this authority trumps any evidence that onlookers might use to ground a prediction. But if anything, this means that it's the onlookers who should lack the credences regarding what she'll do, not the agent herself. After all, they, the onlookers, lack that crucial information the agent has, which grounds her special epistemic authority. And the agent has that information even before she's decided what she's going to do. She has such information before she's decided what she's going to do. You know, the initial tickle, the first inclination towards red wine. So curiously, I say the dark thesis seems to be counter-supported rather than supported by this argument. Having special epistemic authority about a proposition is more reason to assign it a credence, not less. 5.4. Jenny Louise canvasses the following argument. It might be argued, she says, that while there is no logical incompatibility between prediction and deliberation, there's nevertheless a pragmatic contradiction, a Morian paradox. Deliberation about whether to you presupposes agency. That is, it presupposes that I am the kind of creature who can be motivated to act in accordance with my perceived reasons. Prediction that I will you, on the other hand, seems to presuppose the opposite, that I'm merely an object in the world, subject to causal forces outside my control. Using self-prediction in deliberation therefore involves the pragmatic contradiction of assuming both that one is and that one is not an agent. I reply, well, assuming both that one is an agent and that one is not an agent involves a semantic contradiction rather than a pragmatic one. So calling this a Morian paradox is an understatement. And rather, the point seems to be that any agent who has option credences must make inconsistent presuppositions. One, deliberation about what one will do presupposes one's agency. Two, predicting and assigning credences to what one will do presupposes one's non-agency. Hence, option credences require one to make incompatible presuppositions, which is irrational, dark thesis. And I balk at two. And again, it unhappily generalizes to onlookers. Their assigning credences to what I will do presupposes my non-agency. But why? Why must they regard me as merely an object in the world, subject to causal forces outside my control? On the contrary, they may well have a far better understanding of the causal forces under my control in virtue of my agency. For example, by mentally putting themselves in my shoes. And two, unhappily generalizes to my credences about my future self and what I'll do even when I'm not deliberating. And when we see all this, we see how it carries over to my own case when I'm in the midst of deliberation. There's no contradiction, semantic or otherwise, in my assigning credences to what I will do in virtue of my agency. But look, for all I've said and for all of the previous few sections, these agency-based arguments have a grip on us and my various interlocutors. And a common thought is somehow deliberation requires one to take the first-person perspective on oneself, while option credences require one to take a third-person perspective on oneself, and one cannot adopt both perspectives at the same time, although one may adopt one perspective and then another one at another time. It's meant to be a little bit like seeing the duck rabbit first as a duck, and then later as a rabbit, but you can't see it both ways at the same time. But I think this thought can be dispelled somewhat. Notice that this talk of perspectives or seeing as may be misleading here, suggesting as it does one particular occurrent attitude or phenomenological state, and then another. But like beliefs, credences need not be occurrent. You can have a credence without attending to it or being aware of it. And there may not be any associated phenomenological state at all. We often regard groups as agents, and we often attribute beliefs and even credences to them. Groups make decisions, they deliberate about them, it seems. Presumably, the dark thesis should hold for group agents, too, if it holds at all. But such agents do not have phenomenological states. In fact, the thesis seems especially implausible for such agents, perhaps partly for that reason. We're up to 5.5. Now, Levi is the godfather of the dark thesis. No one has argued more for the thesis in greater detail, so I really want to go rather carefully through one of his main arguments. And he's a pragmatist, which is fitting for the John Dewey Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University. And the centerpiece of his pragmatism is his idea, and highlight this because it'll come back to haunt him. Changes in point of view are to be justified by showing that they are optimal, or more generally admissible as options among the available options and relative to the goals of the inquiry. So I want to just underline Changes in point of view are to be justified by showing that they are optimal. Well, let's go through in detail one of his main arguments. One, principles of choice can be applied non-vacuously to determine which of the available options are admissible for the agent and which are not. And admissible, that's a slightly technical Levi term, and it means not ruled out by the principles of choice. But to make it simple, just think of maximizing expected utility. Okay? Admissible means the option is not sub-maximal for expected utility. Hence, there must be available options that are not admissible for her. And now starts a reductio. So suppose for reductio that there is a rational agent who assigns credences to her choices, contra the dark thesis. Four, any such agent must be certain that she will choose rationally. Hence five, only admissible options are serious possibilities for her. That's again a bit of jargon, but just think of it as doxastic possibilities. Hence, six, the admissible options and the available options must coincide for her. Seven, this contradicts two, that completes the reductio. So we have to reject the assumption made at the reductio step. No rational agent assigns credences to her choices. Well, wow, there's a lot to say about that and a lot of places where I disagree. So I won't get through all of them. But how about the inference from 1 to 2? What about when there are ties for which of her options are optimal? So two options have, say, maximal expected utility. Think of Buridan's ass. Maybe she uses a fair coin to make her choice, and as a result she assigns credence half to each of them. And indeed, she's rationally required to do so if she knows that the coin is fair. I would have thought that the principle of choice is used non-vacuously. Yet assuming that there are no other options, all of her available options are admissible. Against four, look, I really want to press on this. So again, that's right, any such agent must be certain that she will choose rationally. Well, I say, look, rational agents need not be smug. They need not be certain that they're rational. In fact, on the contrary, rationality may require them to give positive credence to their not being rational. I mean, among other things, they should realize they may have misleading evidence regarding their rationality. And in any case, whatever their evidence is, it's surely not conclusive. You know, I've had this nice past of seeing all these wonderfully rational things that I've been doing. But that doesn't completely seal the case that I'm rational. Moreover, a rational agent might be certain that she's rational now, but not be certain that she will stay rational. And in particular, she might assign some positive credence to her not choosing rationally when the moment of choice comes. Remember that when later we get to trembling hand equilibrium. Indeed, she shouldn't even be certain that she will choose at all. Against the inference from 4 to 5, let's grant for the sake of the argument that the agent is certain that she'll choose rationally, but she may nonetheless deliberate to figure out what the admissible options are. So she's certain, I'm imagining, that whatever she eventually chooses will be rational, but it takes her a while to figure out what that'll be. And during that time, some inadmissible options are also serious possibilities for her, and they remain so until she rules them out, and then her deliberation concludes. Now, Levi must not reply, "I was assuming that the agent is ideally rational, so she takes no time to figure out what the admissible options are. She just sees them immediately. For then she does not deliberate. Then the thesis isn't really deliberation crowds out prediction for rational agents. Instead, it's rationality crowds out deliberation." The inference from 5 to 6. The natural reading of an option's being available for her is that she is able to perform it. but then six doesn't follow from five. Even when you're certain that you will not perform a given action, you may well be able to perform it. You know, having finally made my decision, I'm certain I'm going to choose the red wine over the white wine. I'm still able to choose the white wine. I just know I won't. And even the shot of petrol, come to think of it. And then general criticisms. I see nothing in this argument that rules out one's having credences for some but not all of one's options. And that seems to be a live possibility, especially when you have several options. So you have assigned credences to some of them, contra the dark thesis, but not some others. I don't see how that's been ruled out. But more importantly, what role did the agent's assigning credences to her own choices play in the argument? So suppose she does not assign such credences, these option credences. The argument goes through just as before, or does not go through just as before. So option credences don't play a role in determining which choices are admissible and which not. Option credences are a red herring. And then finally, remember I asked you to highlight the pragmatism from the John Dewey professor and the changes in view quote, right? Changes in point of view are to be justified by showing that they're optimal. And Levi allows, as I've said earlier, that you can have credences for your choices further in the future when you're not deliberating about them. You know, next Thursday's red versus white wine. But when you begin deliberating about that choice, your credences are supposed to vanish. And then when you've completed the deliberation, they reappear. So by my count, that's two changes in view, but he does not justify them by showing that they're optimal. In fact, I doubt that he could. Okay, and then we've got a couple of betting arguments, which I'll just very quickly go through. So Levi first identifies credences with betting rates, and then he turns to the problem of an agent having a choice between two options, A and B, A strictly preferred to B. And he imagines that she has credences for these options and that she uses these credences to determine fair betting rates. And he shows that the only admissible option is to choose A, the preferred thing, and to regard the fair betting rate for doing so to be one. So fair betting prices for one's options collapse to zero and one. I reply, the problem's not with option credences, the problem's with the betting analysis of credences. And actually, we've long known that there are counterexamples to it. So the betting analysis founders on cases, especially where the placement of the bet is correlated with the proposition bet on. So I am highly confident that I'll fall asleep tonight. Actually, I'm a bit of an insomniac, but still, I eventually fall asleep. So I'm confident I'll fall asleep tonight. Now, imagine I make $1 million bet that pays off just in case I fall asleep tonight. And just picture me at 5 a.m. punching my pillow. Go to sleep. $1 million is riding on this, right? And this is not some, you know, terribly subtle point, and it's just the obvious point that sometimes like bets change things and accordingly one's credences. And actually Levi himself doesn't subscribe to the betting analysis, because elsewhere he doesn't like the diachronic Dutch book argument for conditionalization. He thinks that the agent will see the sure loss coming and, you know, will run away, but that's to reject the betting analysis. 5.7, Spohner's got a betting argument. Let me just go straight to my reconstruction of it. The text's there if you need it. The attractiveness of a bet on one's act depends only on the difference between the bet's stake and its price. That could be shown with a bit of work. In particular, the bet's attractiveness does not depend on the agent's fair betting rate. Hence, the notion of a fair betting rate cannot be applied to a bet on one's act. Here it comes. Credences are fair betting rates. Conclusion, the dark thesis. Well, just note, this has got nothing to do with deliberation. So it should apply equally to your future acts that you're not deliberating about. But again, I just say let's reject the betting analysis of credences for the reason given before. Okay, finally, there's an interesting kind of argument for the dark thesis that they don't play any theoretical role, and so we shouldn't posit them. And Spohn puts it this way: probabilities for acts play no role in decision theory. Well, he goes straight to the dark thesis. Let me put in a couple of extra steps. Hence, our best theory of the decisions of rational agents does not posit probabilities for acts. And if our best theory does not posit such probabilities, then rational agents do not have probabilities for acts. And maybe we could buttress premise three with some sort of Quinean, Lewisian methodological point that our ontology should be dictated by our best theory. Well, against one, probabilities for acts play no role in Savage's decision theory, but they do in other decision theories. Jeffrey, for example, Arsenius's deliberational decision theory. So more on that in a moment. Against three, credences have other theoretical roles besides their role in decision theory. In fact, I would have thought their primary role is to codify uncertainty. And yes, that uncertainty may be parlayed into decision-making, but it's more fundamental, and it may be parlayed elsewhere too, into confirmation relations, into inference, connections to binary belief. So even if probabilities for acts play no role in decision theory, that doesn't mean they play no useful theoretical role. And soon we'll see still more roles. And coming from the other side, there are also theoretical costs to the dark thesis's prohibition of option credences. I've mentioned the clash with conditionalization and the principal principle, the reflection principle, rational reflection, that you should reflect the evidential probabilities. And you may have more specialized experts, as it might be meteorologists when it comes to the weather, maybe psychologists when it comes to what you're going to do. Okay, well, I've already mentioned some theoretical benefits of positing these option credences. You know, codifying uncertainty, the usual interpretation of Jeffrey's decision theory, and that's just the start. Option credences also play a central role in game theory. They're assumed in the notion of correlated equilibrium, in trembling hand equilibrium. That's a refinement of Nash equilibrium that takes into account the possibility of off-equilibrium play through an unintentional slip or a tremble of a hand. And the player's probabilities of such actions are supposed to be negligible, but common knowledge. So common knowledge. So they include each player's probabilities of her own trembles. And option credences are central to Skirmes's deliberational dynamics and to Arsenius's deliberational decision theory, which is inspired by Skirmes's decision, by deliberational dynamics. And I could say more about that later, but the idea is, Frank thinks that we can solve problems like Egan's counterexamples to causal decision theory, death in Damascus and murder legion and cases like this, with deliberational causal decision theory. And these guys have used have still more applications for option credences in deliberational dynamics, modeling the arms race, in Skirmes' case, the emergence of conventions, the social contract. Paul Bartha has appealed to them in connection with Pascal's wager. And in my remaining few minutes, I'll just say something about Pascal's wager and its meeting the dark thesis. And I've got maybe 5 minutes or so, I think. Is that fair? Yep, good. So just let's remind ourselves of Pascal's wager. So you've got the decision matrix, two ways the world could be, God exists, God does not exist, two things you could do, wager for God, wager against God, and you've got that big infinity, the payoff for God exists and you wager for God, salvation. And we calculate the expected utilities for wagering for God, it's infinity, and that exceeds the expectation of wagering against God. Namely, well, you can do the calculations, some finite value. Infinity is bigger than finite. Pascal says, therefore, you should wager for God. And I say the wager is invalid. And I've been saying that for years, but I'm going to say it in a different way now. So now I want to bring in the dark thesis, or first, its denial. So suppose you're deliberating about whether to wager for God or against God, and contra the dark thesis, you assign credences to these options. Then you're already doing something with infinite expected utility. So why bother wagering for God? Just keep deliberating. So for example, if you give point one that you'll eventually wager for God and point nine that you won't, okay? So right now, while deliberating, your expected utility is 0.1 times infinity plus some finite stuff. And that's already infinity. So just keep deliberating. And that's different from the argument that I gave about a decade ago that the wager is invalid. So there I was considering mixed strategies like tossing a coin, what should I do? And all the mixed strategies have infinite expectation. And in fact, even a decision to wager against God can be thought of as, in the end, a mixed strategy. But now, my points instead are, rather than deciding what to do, you could keep deliberating about it. And that's not to choose one of the pure options, and it's not to choose a mixed strategy. And while you're deliberating, you're already enjoying the same infinite expectation that you would were you to wager for God. So you're not better off making up your mind and wagering for God. And now here's the final twist, and then I'm done. Proponents of the dark thesis seem to have a snappy reply to the last point. While you're deliberating, you're not enjoying infinite expectation, because you shouldn't be having these naughty credences like 0.1 and 0.9 to what you're going to end up doing. So, you're not enjoying infinite expectation while deliberating, or indeed any expectation. Your expectation's undefined. Well, of course, I reject the dark thesis, so I'm unsympathetic to this reply, but even granting it, it still shows that the wager is invalid. For now, we must compare your infinite expectation of wagering for God with your undefined expectation of continuing to deliberate. And it's not the case that wagering for God maximizes your expectation, because infinite expectation can't be compared to undefined expectation. It's not the case that infinity is greater than undefined. It's a little bit like, it's not the case that a million is greater than 1/0. You just can't compare them. There's more to be said about that, but I'll just leave it there as a sort of puzzling thought. Okay, so my time's up and I don't want to overstay my welcome. Just to sort of conclude, I like gaps. And I'm intrigued by the thought that there can be blind spots for various propositional attitudes. And I've championed the existence of such gaps for rational credences, and I've marshalled them to argue for my various nefarious projects that various basic probabilistic notions need to be rethought, conditional probability, independence, and so on. And that has important consequences for formal epistemology. Now, the dark thesis, if true, would provide me with more ammunition for my dark theses about the current state of play in these areas. Probability gaps would be as mundane as choosing red wine or choosing to go to Italy for a holiday. So they would arise every time a rational agent deliberates about what to do. But I can't in good conscience help myself to these putative credence gaps. Not only am I unconvinced by the arguments for the dark thesis, I believe there are strong reasons to reject it outright. Okay, so I'm done. When we're finished and we go to the pub, I'm going to reward myself with a glass of wine. And now that you've heard me and you'll go to the pub with me, you'll might want to join me. I'm highly confident, but not certain that I'll choose the red. How about you?
I'm of course very, very sympathetic, but I figured I'd have a go.
Good.
At doing the murky, the blah blah blah, free will blah blah blah.
Good on you. Yeah.
I think I can do better than Price anyway. I'll give you the ideas. I mean, they kind of suck, but they're not terrible individually. Principle thing. If you know the objective probabilities are a certain way, you should calibrate your credences to them, and then we can generalize that a bit, mm-hmm. you know, to case beyond cases where you know. Mm-hmm. Okay? You'll see where the second nugget, when you've got radical free will, the objective probabilities are undefined. I imagine the metaphysical gods have told us that. Mm-hmm. Third idea from Van Inwagen, when we deliberate, we're forced, somehow compelled to presuppose that we have radical freedom. Mm-hmm. And fourth idea, maybe from some neo-Kantian idea, when I'm viewing a deliberational act from the outside, all the evidence is that that is not an exercise of radical freedom.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. I feel those bits will get and they're not like terrible yeah, in themselves.
Good. Okay, cool.
That's my best shot.
Thanks. Let's talk about the bits. So it started with the principle. Actually, interestingly, you might worry that there's already a collision between the principle and the dark thesis. So the thought is when you learn a chance, you've got to make it your credence.
It's an extension of that. I know
what I'm yeah, yeah, that's okay. And so first, just I'll state the worry, and then maybe we can handle it. But so the worry is, what about if I learn the chance of what I'm going to do, red versus white, while I'm deliberating? You know, God tells me right now your chance is 50-50, right, of each of them. Then, by the principle, I must assign a credence, it seems. And that's what the dark thesis says, I must not. So we have a collision. And now maybe the reply would be, well, this is some sort of inadmissible evidence that somehow the principle actually doesn't kick in here. Interesting
it
to hear
be,
why.
Yep. I mean, since yep. radical freedom entails no objective probabilities, yep. if I know yep. there are objective probabilities, then I can no longer maintain the presupposition.
Oh, that's good, yeah. Yeah.
So
good.
Hence, I can't, by the Van Inwagen thesis, deliberate.
Yeah. Yeah, so then, let's say a bit about that. In fact, that one I can maybe even support a little bit, so I'll jump to the dark side. radical freedom, free will, implies the objective probabilities are undefined. So I'm no frequentist. I don't like frequentism. about probability, but I agree that frequencies can be very good evidence for chance claims. And in virtue of my freedom, I can drive a relative frequency like wherever I want to, you know, regarding my choices. And in particular, I can make it not converge at all. I can make it undefined. So, you know, will I raise my hand? You know, there'll be a bell each second. And will I raise my hand or not when the bell rings? You know, give me any number and I can, through my freedom, make the relative frequency of hand raises that number. And more to the point, I can make sure it never converges at all. And so imagine I'm doing this for infinite time. I can see to it that there's no limiting relative frequency. And that, of course, I'm not a frequentist, but still, that is kind of evidence that there's no chance there, that I can so easily do this. So that's, if anything, to be friendly to the argument. So yeah, let one go through. I don't actually really think that.
I know,
neither do you.
But,
that's okay.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's right. And then there was the stuff about deliberation presupposes free will. Yep, that let's just let that through. And then when viewing the deliberational act from the outside, how did that bit go? That's not an exercise of
it's
freedom.
It's like the empirical, when we look at an empirical self, it's unlikely on the evidence we have that they're exercising radical freedom on that occasion.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like a crap hypothesis. The idea is it's got enormously low priors, you know, any sort of deliberational act will manifest radical freedom. This like wild.
Maybe I didn't get that step so much. So
it's like, what are the chances there's this weird agent causation going on?
Yeah.
Just to give you the feel.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, good. So thanks. Yeah. Thanks for that. So I've given some responses, and especially I guess with the principle step. If anything, I worry that's in tension with the dark thesis.
So a follow up.
Yeah. Look, I mean there's. Considering that the precise formulation should be that you have to suspend the use of your credences about your action which are on the menu of deliberation. You may enjoy your credences about other actions, but not about it. And the argument would be something like the following. Suppose that I have a choice between A and B, right? Now, and suppose that I credence 9.5 that I'll do A1. And if I'll do A1, then I'll suffer a terrible consequence. If I'll do A2, I'll have some mild gain.
Yeah.
Now I reason conditional on my subjective probability 9.5 that I'll do A1. I'm going to have the terrible consequence anyhow. So I mean, just as well do A2 and at least get, you know, the $10 in return. This is fallacious reasoning. What's fallacious here? That I've conditionalized on my subjective probabilities about the actions that are under deliberation.
Okay, let me just take that in for a moment. So for start, actually, you didn't state that the dark thesis the way I stated it. In fact, there's an interesting difference, and in fact, this even came up with Hillary earlier. You offered a different thesis, which is actually maybe more plausible, but the way you put it was in terms of suspending use of credences. That's different from the dark thesis that says you do not even have them. Hugh Price had a different version of the dark thesis in Cambridge, which was he called it mute. You mute the credences, and that's still metaphorical, but something like credences no longer play their usual functional role. So their role usually is stuff like fixing betting prices and so on. But in this particular situation, when you're deliberating, they get suspended. It's a bit like, you know, the clutch on a car. You know, it's like disengaging, you know, the gears. So So that was the first comment I wanted to make, that might be actually a more plausible version of the dark thesis. It wasn't the thesis I was discussing, but maybe I should. Maybe that's what the dark siders should say. So that's the main thing I wanted to say. And then there was the bit about conditioning on your probability.
Right.
So what I conditionalize, I say on the evidence that my probability is 0.95 or something. Okay, and again, what was so bad about that?
Oh, then you seem to be forced into irrational decisions. Because, so to speak, just drive it to the extreme so that you have probability 9.999 that you'll do that, right? Okay, so that's for all practical purposes this is going to happen.
Yeah.
But then the alternative, if you don't do that, at least you'll get something, so you may just as well do that because you assume that 9.99 you'll do that terrible thing.
Yeah. See, I would have said the opposite, actually. Thinking of Arsenius, for example, or Skirms, you know, the deliberational dynamics type stuff, that for start deliberation, you might say just is the process of updating your probabilities. I mean, you look at your options and you calculate their expected values from an initial set of credences, you know, across them. And then you look at them and you see how they look, and those that have expected utility above the status quo, you now give a bit more probability to, and the others less, update your credences, do it again, until eventually the probabilities get to equilibrium. And then Frank argues, and this is exactly how you answer Egan and Death in Damascus and these hard cases. So I guess the bit I'm not quite seeing yet is when you said this is going to be irrational to, you know, use this information about your credences. According to these guys, and I see what they're saying, the exact opposite. That's how you stay rational, actually. But anyway.
So a question about the last part. So sometimes two different options both have infinite expected utility, but that doesn't settle the question of which one I should do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes one of them is still better than the other. You know, thinking about, for example, I get to play the St. Petersburg game, or alternatively, I get to play the variant of it where it's the, you know, twice as good in every case.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
They both have infinite utility, but I should go for the better St. Petersburg game rather than the worse one. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like very plausibly a similar thing is going on here. You've got more than one option that are infinitely good, but that doesn't mean they're all equally good. Some of them are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, if it's a case like, just this pretty close to recommending. I mean, if I've got three doors and one of, and I don't know which, where they all go, but one of them goes to heaven, two of them go to New Jersey.
Good.
And now I have the choice between either just going through, picking a door and going, right? Infinite expected utility, it's awesome. Or alternatively, I have the choice of somebody opening and revealing one of the doors to New Jersey, and so I'm not going to go through that one, right? And then making a door, right? Also has infinite expected utility, right? But I should take the second one. I mean, I should rule out one of the bad options.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it seemed like that was the same structure that was going on. I could deliberate and take a chance on whether I'm going to end up wagering for God. Or I could just wager for God, right? And rule out some of the possibility
Good.
of ending up in New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. So,
she's indeed a bet against God.
I spent five years of my life in New Jersey, and actually, I'm not the only one in this room. Good. So, actually, maybe I should have been a bit more careful on what I'm calling Pascal's wager, the argument which I'm then saying is invalid. So in fact, I realize I didn't write it all out. So yes, the decision matrix is one of the premises. And one of the premises is rationality requires you to maximize expected utility. Okay? But it's expected utility. It's not, and when there are ties, turn to some other rules, it's just maximize expected utility, therefore wager for God. And it looked like that was a valid argument because, you know, infinity is bigger than finite, right? So it looked valid. But no, first point, there are these ties. And now we start looking for other rules, and I think this is also what you're saying. Like Schlesinger had a version of this, you know, you should maximize your probability of the infinite, you know, reward when there are these ties. So none of this mixed strategy nonsense, no coin tossing, because that's going to reduce the probability of getting the big prize. And fair enough. So now you can turn to other rules, which is really to say you turn to other rules to decide what to do. So this is now an argument with more premises, and that one might be valid. Right, right. Yeah.
It seems like there's a more plausible premise that they maximize expected utility one that would get you the same result in the wager argument
hold my feet to the fire. It's in my 2003 article, I really did spell out what I took the wager to be, and I think I was fair. You know, these plausible rules were not, you know, in the wager. That argument was invalid. This is another way of showing that it's invalid because, you know, by its lights, continuing to deliberate is just as good. And now we turn to other arguments with further premises about what you do in these weird infinite cases. Yeah. By the way, just a thought, that it's not just even these weird infinite cases where there's something funny about the dark, what the dark thesis will say. So now I'm just choosing between red and white wine, nothing infinite. And I realize one of my options is to just keep deliberating. But if I keep deliberating, and now by the dark thesis, I assign just undefined probability to my options, it looks like my expectation is undefined while I continue deliberating. And then I just make the point again. How do you compare undefined with the numerical value of the expected utility of red wine, for example? Red wine does not maximize expected utility because red, you know, its number is not bigger than undefined. So that's a little curiosity there.
Yeah, so just so we were talking earlier about the case in some cases where you might initially think the right thing to say is undefined and maybe more appropriately model as intervals.
Yeah.
And that strikes me as one of them, which could maybe make the problem go away. If your two options eventually really are just red wine and white wine,
yeah.
And the other thing that's going on is some kind of mixture, maybe not sure what probability is, maybe it's an interval value probability between red and white. It sort of seems like, you know, at any rate, the expected utility of that thing can't be anything outside the interval that's bounded by the utility of red and the utility of white.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
yeah.
It seems like we're still going to get some intelligible sense in which, if red is the one that has the higher utility, going for red is going to maximise expected utility, even when the option of keeping deliberations on the table. Something like that.
Yeah.
This is a bit
I think it was good. That's right. Yeah, you surely do get a fix on the expected utility that you currently enjoy when your options are red and white, and you can put a fix on them. That's right. It's no worse than the lower and no higher than the higher value, so it should be an interval. And yeah, we talked a bit about this before, that this is not the dark thesis that says you should assign interval probabilities to your acts when you're deliberating about them. But maybe it's sort of in the spirit of the dark thesis. You know, so the dark thesis would say you just go undefined on these option credences. And then at the other end would be, no, it's quite okay to give sharp numbers, 50-50. And then a sort of splitting the difference view would be, you can assign credences, but they have to be spread out. And bit of a rapprochement, perhaps.
Let me sharpen it a little bit. So here is an example. Suppose that I'm an avid smoker, and I have a choice of continue of quitting smoking or having another pack of cigarettes. Now, I know about myself, I'm not going to stop smoking, right? I mean, chances are negligible, right? So given that I'm not going to stop smoking, I may just as well opt and enjoy the cigarette, right? Right? Mm-hmm. That follows, but conditional that I'm not going to follow, that I may just as well take the cigarettes, right? But this is the rational thing to do is to stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So here is the conflict.
So,
and why? Because I conditionalize on what I'm going to do anyhow prior to the deliberation.
And so how did you know what you're going to do?
Well, it
sounds like your deliberation's over.
I give credence very high.
Credence very high.
So about my notes about yourself. This is what you've been relying all along.
Your
notes about yourself.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just also add, this is a thesis about rational credence, okay? So this sounded like some sort of weakness of will case or something, that
end up getting a rational decision if you allow yourself to conditionalize on what you expect to do, and which is under deliberation.
How are you calculating the expected utilities of quitting smoking when you conditionalized on your continuing to smoke?
Again, I'm sorry. You're asking me?
Yes.
In this case where you're trying to compare the expected utilities of continuing to smoke or quitting smoking, but it's after you've conditionalized on continuing to smoke. Just how do you get the...
Well, I put it as an input into the subjective probabilities. Now I continue my deliberation.
Yeah, no.
Well, but if it goes... I mean, if you have credence zero that you're going to quit smoking...
No, I don't think it's zero.
So
if it's very small.
If it's very small, then how is the expected utility lower? I mean, the expected utility of stopping smoking X hypothesis is higher than the expected utility of continuing to smoke, even if your credence that you'll do it is very low. So I'm just not seeing how the low credence that you're going to do the expected utility maximizing thing winds up interfering with its status as the expected utility maximizing thing.
Yeah, when you mix over these two possibilities of not smoking and smoking, not smoking lifts the average, and so it looks better than pure smoking.
I mean, there was something that you were doing that is a Bayesian disaster, which is you're really confident, you think, well, I'm almost certain, so for all practical purposes, I'm certain, so let's treat it as one, conditionalize it. You can't do that. You just can't do that.
Yeah.
Bayesian agents don't do that.
Yeah.
They can't do that.
Yeah, so you are, I guess, put it as a dilemma. So first you really meant probability one, okay? So... And now how are you calculating, how non-smoking looks if you're certain you're going to smoke? And then if it's not one, because then you said, no, it's high, it's not one. So now you've really got the expectation of these two terms, but one of the terms is going to lift the expectation relative to smoking. So you won't have to smoke. Yeah.
Okay, one more, then we have a new question.
It sounded like another thing that was a factor in that example was the coordination across time was the issue, right? So you're thinking about, then it seems like, so given that, knowing me, bracketing this particular occasion, thinking about what I'm going to do, for the rest of my life after this cigarette. Well, in that case, it could well be that, the rational thing to do is to have that particular cigarette, supposing that you are in fact going to, have all the other ones after, given that this one wouldn't help, right? That doesn't look like the wrong answer, though.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back to your newly opened front on your war against Pascal's
future,
just a clarification question, actually. So you talk about how you already have this infinite expected utility while you're delivering, so why not keep delivering, right?
Yeah.
So is the idea that you're just going to keep on delivering forever, like either yeah. like eternally or like until you die or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
But then isn't the problem that the expectation, you're assigning credence point one to your wager to figure out when your deliberation ends, but if it never ends, like how would you ever wager for God, right? So I mean, I don't understand, like, if you know that you're going to be deliberating eternally, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just, maybe I'm just confused. Like,
you might keep deliberating after you die.
Oh yeah, so I mean, what I'm saying is, if you do plan on infinitely deliberating, like, even after your death or whatever, it seems like you'll never have an opportunity
to win. All right, okay, so I can answer that. It doesn't have to be I decide now to infinitely deliberate. It's just, should I deliberate a bit longer, you know?
Okay.
So, yeah, right now, yeah, okay, let's deliberate for another few seconds.
Right.
And then a few seconds later, I do it again, and then I do it again, and I keep on comparing my current status.
But it seems that if I were sufficiently reflective, I might think,
Look where this is going.
Yeah, look into the future and be like, there's never going to be a point in which everybody like, yeah, I should wager now one way or the other way, right? I mean, I'm just concerned that even if you have this kind of time limit, then you're going to, you know, sort of like one of those exam paradoxes, except that there's no end. Right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Can I ask something about
that? Yeah,
does that setup really actually require you to add another row on for continuing to deliberate, and then you're actually going to stick an infinity in the God exists box for that row? Because that doesn't seem like the right way to deliberate.
Well, it's,
yeah, it's like, is he going to reward you continue?
Well, no, it's not quite that, but that's interesting.
I see, it's not exactly the mixed strategy.
Yeah,
it's different.
Exactly, that's right. But offhand, it seems like it's an option. It's something you could choose. I won't settle yet. I'm going to deliberate a bit more. And it's not that God then gives you an infinity for that. It's just, I was imagining you're assigning credences while deliberating to wagering for God, wagering against God.
Mm-hmm.
I said 0.1, 0.9. And so your expected utility, just calculate it the usual way. You know, it's 0.1 times the expected utility you get if you finish up wagering for God, and that's infinity. So, I mean, if you can sort of see what I'm doing here, you know, you've got that's the calculation for wagering for God, that's wagering against, and now the overall, your expectation of deliberation, I'm imagining, is, you know, 0.1 times the first row, right, which is infinity. You know, so wagering for God, I don't even need all the intermediate numbers, I needed expectation of wager 4 equals infinity for wager against. It's finite, and then the expectation of the strategy, which I was imagining is like, I don't want to make it sound like a mixed strategy, but it's by your current lights, it is. You know, deliberation is 0.1 times infinity plus 0.9 times finite. But it's there's still some puzzles here, and this is now not specifically about the dark thesis, but it's still interesting. So, originally, there were two options, right? Wager for, wager against. And now I think, hang on, there's a third option. Keep deliberating. So now it looks like a decision problem with three options. God, I better start deliberating about this three-option problem. Should I keep deliberating about it? That sounds like a fourth option. Regress, yeah. Go.
I'm just getting confused about this last case.
Okay.
So there are two really importantly different ways I can increase my expected utility, right? And the one that we're usually not interested in is changing my credences so that I believe good stuff will happen, like in the absence of any evidence.
Yeah.
And sort of, I don't know if it's sometimes being taught, it feels like there's something uncomfortably like that bad way of increasing your expected utility that's coming into the discussion in this case. Like we're talking about whether it will be a good idea, whether it will be rational to do something that increases my expected utility by changing my credences. If I'm the non-dark picture, the point is, well, while you're in a state of deliberation, your credences are split, and we want to capture the sense in which moving your credence towards wagering for good might be a good thing. That sounds as misguided as saying, oh, I should believe there's £1 million in my bank account, because
it might be feeling good.
Subjective expected utility.
Yeah. I didn't think it was like that. But
right.
So, you know, for whatever reason, right now you do have 0.1 credence that you'll end up wagering for God, and 0.9 that you don't. And there's not an issue about should I now raise it, you know, wishful thinking or something. It's just these are my credences for these end states. And my expected utility right now, and it's that which is infinite, and that's not saying, and now I should do the silly reasoning and increase my probability or something of getting a good thing. It's just that is how things look from my current vantage point.
Yeah, but you were saying the opposite thing, right? You were saying according to the maximized expected utility prescription, and now I'm worrying about whether it's being misapplied. According to the maximized expected utility prescription, there is no case for terminating the deliberation because it doesn't increase the expected utility. And it kind of feels uncomfortably as though the kind of increase of expected utility you'd be getting here is any way of the irrelevant kind.
Maybe you're right, but what I was imagining is I now just take seriously two of my options, wagering for God. Yes, Pascal, you were right. That has infinite expectation. And now one other option. Deliberate some more. And that has infinite expectation. And Pascal says, well, you've got to maximize expected utility. You've got to do something that's maximal. And I say, I am. I'm deliberating. And that, okay.
Isaac, follow up. And then Cherry is the last one.
Okay, so just commenting a little bit on what Hilary was bringing up about the increasing your credence about having £1 million in the bank account, something like that. I think that there's a relative difference there in the sense that if I increase my credence and actually wager on that there is £1 million in my bank account, it's not going to make any difference to the fact that there's going to be £1 million in the bank account. Whereas in the wager case, actually believing that or increasing your credence in that is actually going to bring about this eternity in heaven, if in fact the God hypothesis is true.
Right?
There's a big. Oh, is that what she said?
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, okay.
That is also
I didn't
a difference.
Want to repeat something.
Yeah, no.
So I mean, I think that's a hugely relevant difference.
Yeah. That.
Coming back to what I was saying earlier, I think another way of framing it is that if we do think about, well, I'm going to deliberate for T more seconds or something like that, and then if we do the iterative thing, then the kind of inference that you might draw is, if I eventually stop deliberating and wager, then I'll get this infinite expected utility.
Mm.
But I can infer from my kind of reflection on this process that I will never come to deliberate, and so therefore my expected utility should go to zero then. Right? So I mean, that's just another way of posing the thing. Right?
I should look further ahead and see.
I'd like to see the derivation that you'll never. I mean, it's only that there's no clear choice between these two. It's not I've got an awesome case for deliberating over wagering right now. I mean, it's a bit of a toss-up.
Oh,
so
right.
Yeah.
Who's to say that the toss-up's going to break?
Okay, wait. If we say, it'll be a toss-up, but if I choose this route, then I'll know, and I can make reflective inference, now I'm going to wager, so therefore it actually will end up being zero, right?
No, I mean,
no.
The way you choose that is
deliberating from a moment. I see where I'm going.
Because
I might end up at a toss-up at that end of that moment, and then I might go the other way.
So
maybe it's more like a mixed strategy. But you can't end up saying, I'm going to deliberate for an infinite amount of time, because then you'll know that you'll never wager.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, yes. But it's like a series of, you know, Baradin's ass cases.
Right.
You know, every second.
You need to be able to stop at some point and make the choice.
Yeah. Yeah, but at each choice point, you know, Baradin's ass, I can rationally go both ways when Pascal says I must go one way.
Okay, that clarifies a lot.
Yeah.
True.
So I was just going to ask a really big picture question, because I'm very new to this discussion, and I'm having a very difficult time seeing why they would find this thesis plausible. So here's, when I just think about how I deliberate, here's what strikes me as a natural picture. I tend to prefer red to white, so I sort of think, well, probably I'm 0.7 red, you know, right now. And then as I get over there, maybe I rethink it, and I think, oh, it's a sunny day, maybe white would be nice. And then I go, maybe 0.6 white, and then I sort of go back and forth, and maybe at some point I'm 0.5, and then if you want to account for free will, maybe at some point there's this unexplainable, I decide to go for white. So at what point, if I assign credences to red and white all along throughout that entire picture, like, at what point have I done something irrational on their view?
Yeah.
Is this a coherent question?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I just am not really in the grip of where I would go wrong.
Yeah, well, of course, you've got all the right intuitions, but but still, one of the key thoughts seems to be this Ramsey ultimate contingency, you know, point that my current choice just screens off all this other evidence, and in particular, I think you began by saying something like, you know, well, in the past I've, you know, whatever, done a bit more red than white. And so Hugh Price would say, no, you can't use that evidence because your choice being the ultimate contingency, the past is now independent of what you do. So, that, well, the thought begins with that, I think, and then it's supposed to go the further step and say, and so you have no evidence whatsoever. And then...
And so it could be that I'm 0.7 red, and then I get there and I choose red, and I just... There is no point at which I deliberate. Is that also an option?
That's it.
So there is no point at which I fail to assign a credence. I just choose red.
Yeah, so that's my view, that you all along you're assigning credences, and then, well, I guess at a certain point they get sufficiently high that you just choose red. But, I didn't quite...
Oh, I was just wondering if on their view I always deliberate, or if in some cases I do this other thing, jump.
Oh, maybe in some cases you do, but while deliberating, can you coherently assign credences at the same time? And you know, Price would say, well, no, because some of that would be to think that you've got evidence for what you're going to do, and you don't.
Okay.
And that's the exact point where I disagree with him.
Yeah.
I say you do, and you've got more evidence than anyone else.
Yeah. Let's call it there so we have enough time to go up, and let's thank
Thanks a lot.